Welcome to It's All Journalism. I'm Megan Cloherty here with Michael O'Connell. And today we have with us an investigative journalism A-team. And there's no reaction. Aw.
Hi,
Tisha
guys.
Thompson and Rick Yarborough. Tisha and I are old friends. I met Rick through IRE, investigative reporters and editors. They became a team while working for the Fox affiliate in D.C. for years before moving over to the NBC affiliate here in town, NBC4. They've won way too many awards to count, we've decided, but their work has helped change state laws, prompted arrests, and the firing of public officials. Welcome.
Thank you.
Doing the good work out there.
Trying to.
I thought we'd just get started with just a little bit of background, you know, education and sort of where your careers, how your career has led you to where you are.
You want me to go first?
Sure.
Okay, so I went to public schools and I never wrote for the high school newspaper. I did a little bit of poetry class and stuff like that. I mean, I loved English and history, so I was a liberal arts person. I got into Princeton University, so I went to Princeton because when you get in, you should go. And I wrote one sort of weekly periodical article the whole time I was there. So journalism wasn't the most natural thing for me. But I did do a couple of internships. I did an internship at MTV, which was really fun. With the news, MTV News, when they were very active in the political scene with Rock the Vote and stuff like that. And then I did another internship with Sam Donaldson when he was the White House correspondent at ABC News. And that was really a fascinating time because they were primetime and 2020 and the White House. I was getting all that exposure at the same time. So after those internships, I decided to go to grad school to really get, for no other reason, a tape put together. To get live shot experience and that sort of thing. So I went to University of Missouri, where I know Megan went to. And we were actually at school at the same time.
Michael deeply sighs.
Yeah.
Zoom comes up all the time.
Yeah. Well, I was a grad student. Megan was an undergrad. And after that, I started doing the real thing. The reason why I liked the graduate program at the University of Missouri was because you did live shots. You were really on television. But as a grad student, you were basically going to school and getting credit for going to work 5 days a week. And I was covering the Missouri State Legislature. At the same time, it was the 2000 presidential election, so I got to go to the national conventions. At the same time, our governor died in a terrible plane crash, so I got to cover that because I was the State House reporter. And that was the same year that he was running against John Ashcroft for the Senate race.
Wow.
And it became a really famous race. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you had Bush v. Gore and all that going on. You had the Ashcroft-Carnahan race where a guy was running against a dead candidate and what happened with that. And he actually ended up losing to the dead guy. So it was just a fascinating time. I had so much exposure. And so it was a little bit of luck, but also it was the fact that I was going to school, but I was really reporting 5 days a week.
Yeah, you did the work. You put yourself there.
Oh, yeah.
And you took advantage of the fact
And then I had to write a thesis about it. So being forced to analyze and looking back at what you've done over the course of several semesters and what was worth the time and wasn't worth the time, it was a very good experience. Mm. I highly recommend Missouri to anybody who's ever been interested in doing television on or behind the scenes, which brings me to Rick.
Yeah, so Tisha's on the air and Rick is producing behind the scenes.
Yeah, and I like to point out to Tisha a lot, I did not go to Princeton, and we're in the same place.
Well, No. I pointed it out to him for the first time when we were happy. You know, everyone's like, oh my God, you went to Princeton. I'm like, yeah, but I've got more debt, and we are working together at the same place, and he's got a lot less debt than me. So I don't know who the smarter of the two is.
Now, I grew up down south. I grew up in South Carolina, and I knew from an early age that I enjoyed writing. I was always a creative writer and all through school. And knew I wanted to be a journalism major and went to the University of South Carolina, majored in broadcast journalism, worked at the campus TV station. I was the anchor there. And it was actually a great experience. It was during the Susan Smith case in Union, South Carolina.
Oh, wow.
So I was getting to go up and cover that every day as a college student. So it was an amazing experience to see such a national event localized right in our own backyard in South Carolina. When I graduated, I wanted to be a reporter. And but the local NBC station in Columbia, South Carolina was looking for a morning show producer and I needed a job. So I was like, all right, I'll check that out. Let me check that out. And actually, WIS, the TV station, called the university and said, is there anyone that you could recommend? And since I was working at the campus TV station, they threw my name out there. So I got an interview and I went and got the job. I trained for 3 days with a morning show producer and then he left me. And I had a 2-hour show to produce, and I had really no idea what I was doing.
Wow.
So it was really jump in, you know. And so I did that for several years. I worked at WIS and moved up. I became the supervising producer there, was producing their main newscast. And I got to do amazing things. Like I got to produce the GOP national primary, presidential primary debate that came through South Carolina with Brian Williams at the time. I was 21 years old. So, I mean, the experience I got by being a small TV station in Columbia, South Carolina, which WIS is a dominant station, so I got to do so many different things there, was just, you know, invaluable for me.
Can I ask you a question?
Of course.
Why did you decide you didn't want to be a reporter? I've never asked you that after 10 years.
What I usually tell people is that I found out being a producer behind the scenes, I could control more.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a control freak. Yeah. And actually, that probably stems from me being a line producer for 5 years, where, you know, you're in charge of what's in your show. You're stacking your show. You're picking the graphics. You're deciding what's your lead. So you start getting that control, and you're dealing with all the different reporters. And I'm like, I kind of like being in control of several things, not just my one little story. And that's probably what.
Because I think it's worth mentioning. I mean, he's gorgeous enough to be on TV. And so you oftentimes...
I paid her before we came in.
But, there, you know, oftentimes a lot of people are like, do I go on air? Do I go off air? And for me, my natural inclination was to be off air. His natural inclination was to be on air. And here we are all these years later, completely opposite.
Right.
And I think it probably works well like this. We've discovered that we do have strengths that the other one doesn't necessarily have, and that's what complements each other so well.
I hate to ask this, being an ugly person.
No,
so should
stop
I,
it.
Should I just not consider going on air because of the way I look? I mean, is that
I have to tell you, the television business is a brutal business, and you can do the most profound, groundbreaking, hard-hitting investigation, and people will write you in about what your hair looked like, what you were wearing, whether you were too fat, your lipstick was too red.
Right.
That's all your boss sometimes cares about. I've had bosses who would only come to me about the color of the lipstick I was wearing.
And social media has opened up a can of worms on that,
where
people
it.
Immediately respond to your stories, which is great, but it also opens up that they can, you know, be
bash
nasty.
You,
they,
for lack of a better way of putting it.
That's why I think the first market is so hard, because you're learning, you're making a ton of mistakes, you're getting the first feedback on your looks from random strangers. And you sort of establish that sort of shell,
television,
right,
is all about what you look like. I mean, it's true. That doesn't mean you have to be beautiful at all. It just means that you have to have a super thick skin, and you have to be willing to let everyone have their opinion and tell you what they think about you and just keep trucking forward. And you have to be willing to take advice about how to improve whatever it is that isn't working. I mean, I've had so many consultants, and I've had so many bosses who've said, let's go this direction, let's go that way. But you also have to be confident in yourself. I mean, when I first started, you remember, I lopped all my hair off. And this is stupid. Here we are talking about investigative reporting, and now I'm talking about my hair. But that's what television is. And I've slowly but surely just started letting it grow longer and longer, and no one said anything to me. So awesome, right?
Do you think that that's a harder road for women to travel on television?
No, I think it's equally difficult. I think for men, I mean, Rick can speak more to this, but I think for men—
as a handsome man behind the camera.
The difficulty for men is they look young. And they need to look wise, and someone who is in their 70s has to look at you and hear you on television and believe what you're saying. And if you look like you're 10 years old, why would I watch you on television? So for men, it's sort of the opposite. They desperately want to get older and more statuesque, you know. And then women, we just want to stay young and skinny. So, you know,
you want to get a little gray around the temples if you're a man. I didn't want to necessarily take us down this superficial road, but it is.
No, but I'm happy to talk about it, because I think a lot of people think that it's all about the journalism. But no, when you're on television, it's all about
what
you look like.
It
does. It matters.
It does.
And what you want to do is you want to minimize the distraction about what you look like, so that people are listening to what you're saying. And if you can get rid of all of the chatter and just be sort of ordinary and not extraordinary in either direction, then they will pay attention to what you're saying.
And relatable.
Yeah. And relatable is incredibly important. And that you were talking about small market. Yeah. Part of the small market is learning to just be yourself, learning to have confidence in yourself, and learning
and be comfortable on air.
And being comfortable on air is difficult. It's hard. That's why, I mean, I challenge anyone to go to the museum and read a teleprompter. Because it's incredibly awkward.
And have their eyes not move from
side to side.
Because
it's not normal.
It's
awkward
to
read something and be, you know, live on the air.
Well, speaking of television journalism, as far as what you guys do, not only is it challenging, I mean, it has obvious challenges, but then there's the challenge of being investigative in a local television newsroom, which anymore is far and few between.
I was told a long time ago by a very smart investigative journalist that it's cyclical. It peaks and it valleys. And we went through a very nasty valley about 3-4 years ago where truly Rick and I were the only game in town. And frankly, we were the only game in a lot of towns.
For local TV.
For local television. The recession just walloped local television just like it did everybody else. Mm-hmm. But when that happens, you have to start cutting. And the easiest and fastest places to cut are the ones that seem fatty. And iTeams take a long time to turn less product and have a lot of bodies. And it's like, well, what are we wasting our money on this? We need someone who gets on TV every day. We have come back from that cycle and we're on the upswing right now. I kid around. I mean, Rick's heard me kid about this, that the consultants have told every local television station to hire an iTeam because nobody had an iTeam because they let them all go, right? And so, but truly what it is that there's more money out there. And I would like to believe with the advent of the internet and with this, you know, this fighting for whatever, you know, share you can get of the ratings, they've realized that people really do tune into investigative journalism. And I'd like to believe there's been a philosophical shift. And it's easy to have a philosophical shift when you've got more money. And so there's more money right now. And so we now have an investigative unit at all four of the television stations in Washington, D.C., whereas 3 years ago,
We were talking about that because we said, you know, I feel like journalism evolved from being like more in-depth to all of a sudden punch, punch, punch with social media, just a lot of short stories, a lot of live shots, and then you're back to the anchor. And people are now tiring of that format and want more meat.
How do you compete with BuzzFeed? How do you compete with Yahoo? How do you compete with Instagram and Twitter? Because that's where people go, Facebook, that's where people go for most of their consumption, right? The one thing local television can offer you is maybe weather, but definitely homegrown investigative reporting, because BuzzFeed can't be BuzzFeeding in Washington, D.C. like we can.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
But that being said, investigative reporting has definitely changed in the years that we've been doing it. I mean, it no longer are the days where you're only turning stories for the four main sweeps periods, the Februarys, the Mays, the July, Novembers. We're turning every week. I mean, our unit, we have stuff on between Tisha and Scott McFarlane, another reporter. I mean, every week we have stuff on. And years ago, that was not the case for
investigative reporters. I think, and this is truly the secret to success with investigative reporting, at least for local television, is a twofold process. I think you have to underpromise and overdeliver. And when you say you're going to give a story, it better be so much better than what the boss expected so that you get to do it a second time. I mean, I tell young reporters that all the time. They come to their boss and they say, I want to investigate this, but they haven't put all the pieces together yet. And then it just doesn't come together. And the boss goes, oh, well, they're full of it, right?
By the time we pitch a story, we pretty much know we can do it and what the elements are, because we don't want to promise something we can't.
And then we hold back on some nuggets because we don't want them to get too excited so that when we do hit, it's like, whoa, that was so much better than I expected. I think the other thing that's incredibly important is to always be churning product. And whether it's on television or not, your boss is fully aware of the fact that you're always juggling a ton of stuff and that you're keeping yourself relevant and you're looking to be helpful to the entire newsroom and you're not sitting in a corner being elitist.
I was going to say, every once in a while they pull you out and have you do, you know, if something's breaking or whatever,
sort of manifestation of it. I've done GA with a little investigative nugget here or there. I've been mostly investigative who has to go cover Sunday news. Right. I've been the investigative reporter who suddenly gets thrown into GA and make it better because you're the investigative reporter. Right now, I'm in a pretty good place where if we have a really serious breaking news situation, I'm bringing that something extra. And our other partner in our unit, Scott McFarlane, he's really turning the quick stuff because it allows me to, with Rick, to really focus in on those groundbreaking ones, because that's what I want to do. I don't want to do something I saw in another market.
Right.
I want to do a story that is truly local, that is breaking news, that people haven't seen before, which is very hard to do because there's no such thing as a story that someone hasn't done before.
As far as how-tos, because we have a lot of student listeners, and I think that a lot of people are interested in like the actual brass tacks of what you do, like where you get story ideas, how you're managing, if you're turning every week, how you're managing four or five stories at one time.
Rick needs to talk about the real secret to our success.
No, I mean, most of the stuff that we are turning, we're pitching ourselves. I mean, we have a tip line, we have an email tip line, we have a phone tip line. We're constantly checking that. And a lot of our stories come from sources. And actually, it's interesting, Tisha and I talk often about how a lot of our sources that come forward with story ideas are people that we've done stories about in the past who, after their stories already aired, said, you guys nailed that on the head and you guys, you know, were very fair, even though we didn't like what you were doing at the time. And maybe you should look into this. So we find that happening a lot more and more these days
because our reputation. Anybody.
We try to be so fair about this. We don't want to ambush people. We don't like the word ambush. Mm-mm. We don't. That's, you know, that kind of thing.
If you see me running after somebody, it has been a long road to running after that person. That person has not answered our questions through all different types of media.
That's the last.
But we also don't burn people because we work. We like it here. We don't want to go anywhere, right? So it's a small town. It's the same people that you got to come to over and over again. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the stories are going to be good stories. Sometimes the stories are going to be sort of tough for whatever agency it is. And so you treat people with respect. You tell them what's coming at them. I don't want someone in an interview to be like, I don't know what you're talking about, so I can't answer that. That's a stupid interview. So we actually really let people know ahead of time all the stuff we've got. And that sometimes shocks people. But I'd rather have an informed interview than have someone just sit there and doesn't know what they're talking about.
Before we did the crucial interview with this government employee, we sat down with him.
For
an hour and a half and showed him everything that we had that we were going to be asking him about because we wanted him to give us legitimate answers.
Did you worry about losing him then?
Nope.
I mean, him backing out?
Because I'll get him.
Yeah,
We'll get him. So we, as I often say, we can do this in a well-lit room where you know what's coming at you and you have thought about what your answers are going to be. Because just saying, I don't know, doesn't answer a question. Or we can do this when you're not expecting me. And typically I'm saying this to someone's public relations person.
Again,
right?
As a last resort.
This is a last resort.
Calls, after the emails, after the letters where they've just avoided us. You know,
if it's the kind of story that matters.
Right.
It's got to be a story that is like life or death. Like this is the stuff that is important.
And they appreciate the fact of your openness.
They come and they give us
tips. Seriously, tips are our bread and butter. That's what we do. And also what we ourselves observe in our communities. I mean, so many of our best stories has been something Tisha has seen driving into work or something I've noticed. And we're like, that's weird. You know, did you notice that? And we start looking around.
You have to be skeptical.
You have to be. I think I love something you told me one time. I think it was a professor here said, go within a one block area and find how many stories.
My investigative reporter investigative reporting professor at University of Missouri, I was the only television person. It was Brand Houston. It was all international people who want to do international reporting. He said, all right, we're going for a walk. And we said, okay, where are we going? And we walked around the block where we went to the bars and we went to the drugstore, and this is the same block we walked every single day. It was 9th Street, if you want reference. And we walked downtown Columbia, Missouri. And we walked the entire block, and he turned to us and he said, all right, give me 10 stories.
Oh my gosh.
And we were like, what are you talking about? Give me 10 stories. Well, in television, the photographers this was a great thing that everybody did when I worked in Paducah, Kentucky. When they first got hired, they had to shoot a license plate 10 different ways. And then they got the job. Well, they could all do like 7. Right. So come up with 10 stories in a single block. And it was fascinating stuff. It was like the bar that we all went to, on Friday nights was owned by the same guy that owned all the bars on 9th Street. And it was because as one would get shut down for serving underage drinking, he'd just open up another one over here. He owned the whole block. Well, you'd only know that if you went into real estate records and you traced who all these companies were really owned by, and you had to learn how to find those records and go through tax records. And then there were all these land swaps that had happened. There was emergency services problems, but you would have to know how to find those records. And that's what I liked about that exercise. Mm-hmm. I still do it. I'd say about 50% come from tips and about 50% come from our gut. Something's just not right.
And then we're juggling anywhere from 10 to 12 stories at a time. So we are very organized. As a producer, I think that's probably
you're
one of my
best. You are very organized.
Well, yes.
And I hold on to your coattails.
That is one of my better skills. That I'm very organized with the stories. Every story that we're working on has a folder, you know, an electronic folder in our system where we have contacts and notes. And so if any of us get hit by a bus, as Tisha often says, somebody else can look in there and know where we were
pick
at with the story
and
pick it up and keep going with
right.
it. What we've shot, who we need to get still.
And we're diligent. You may not
we
hear from
up.
Us for a couple of weeks, but that doesn't mean we've given up. It just means I've been working on a different project. But, oh, by the way, hey, where are those documents you promised me? So
right.
that's why when you hear when we say we've been working 6 months, we've been working 9 months, we've been working a year, we really have. Every week we're sending an email going, where's my stuff?
Right.
Give me my documents. It's typically those longer form stories are typically two reasons. One, it's whatever agency is really fighting us on giving us paperwork that we have a right to as American citizens, and it's the government's paper, right? Or it's surveillance.
Surveillance takes an insane amount of time. Yeah.
Well, that takes us to FOIAs. How often do you guys FOIA, and can you give us any
tips
as to like getting specifically what you want?
I mean, we're putting FOIAs out every week, several.
Our partner Scott puts about five FOIAs out a day.
He does dozens a week, and he's very good at maintaining that. We're all putting FOIAs out constantly, and the thing is, you got to know what the laws are in each of the jurisdictions in Maryland, Virginia. D.C., they're all very different rules about how long they have before they can respond, et cetera. The biggest tip I would give is don't always FOIA, because sometimes you're going to get the information without a FOIA. Call the public information officer and say, here's what I'm looking for. If in general, we usually don't give them specifics on what we're obviously looking for in the FOIA.
Okay.
But say, this is kind of the information we're looking for. Could you get that to me, or is that going to require an open records request? And if they say that's going to need to be a FOIA, then we try to talk to sources or people on the inside that know specifically what kind of documents we should be looking for, what they're called, because a lot of the battle sometimes will be you didn't ask for the right paperwork.
They will nail you on that.
If you didn't ask for the specific right name of that document, they can deny it. And that can just, you know,
They can try to deny it.
But
it'll just cost you another 30 days.
So right. It's worth doing research on what you're looking for, what kind of documents you're looking for, what these documents are called, who maintains those documents, what kind of information is in those documents. So you can be as specific as you can in the FOIA request.
To give a really good example, we just recently did our beer bus series, and we knew exactly what we wanted. We knew the document we wanted. But we got, three different versions of something
else? Well, at first
they
said they didn't maintain it.
They didn't maintain it.
The information.
And then they sent a database that didn't
have what we
quite
wanted.
Get it.
So this
and
just
it,
delays you because you have to
yeah.
keep
yes.
requesting.
You just,
and you're
you go,
on the phone
no,
constantly
that's not
talking
what I'm talking
to them.
About. I've heard you've got this.
And we actually, here's the thing, our tipster had given us a copy of it, so we knew what it looked like, we knew what it was called, we knew it existed, and they're like, we don't have that. And we're like...
But that started to become the story. And that's the important part is as you're fighting these fights, you have to say, well, do you really not have it? Because if you really don't have it, that may be the story because people think you got it.
Right.
And in this case, not having it and not being able to track it and it becoming part of the story that they couldn't keep track of the inventory of their beer. And thus, as we're being told by our sources, they're having people steal from them because no one knows where the beer's going.
And in that case, they did actually have the form, but they didn't have it in electronic form. It was just they were actually still paper-based. Yeah. So we ended up going into the office, and they pulled all those paper records, and we spent 2 weeks going through page by page.
And then what else happened that day, Tisha? Isn't that the one you got locked in?
Yeah.
Oh, this has actually happened a couple times to me. It was the first time it happened.
Well, first time for me.
I mean, when you come to look at let me back up and say – so oftentimes you'll be given exemptions and you can't just accept those exemptions on their face value, like national security or privacy, or those are basically the two. So,
and that's been big recently.
Been
national
big.
Security has been a huge reason.
Like
a lot of agencies.
Anytime you ask for information about transportation, they're going to tell you that you can't have it because of national security. I'm like, how is a sign falling down or a bridge inspection report a national security issue? I mean, so much so there was this bridge in Prince George's County that literally had less than 30 people a day driving over it in the woods, out in the country. And I was being told I couldn't see the inspection report for Homeland Security exemptions. So what you do, I mean, sometimes they're legit. I did a series of stories in Baltimore about evacuations after Hurricane Katrina. Well, those evacuation plans could endanger national security. If you know how to keep people from evacuating, you could really hurt a lot of people very quickly, right? So there are legitimate and then there's not so much legitimate. And I use the legitimate examples as saying, look, I have been able to see these documents that had legitimate homeland security concerns. This is not that. Mm-hmm. And typically when you have that conversation, you say, let me just see these documents. They eventually let you in the door. So we've done that a couple of times where we just get in the door just to see because it may not be what we want. It may be what we want. We don't know. Let's look at them, right? You should have access to your government records. Like, we as a people have access. But what will happen on the flip side is you have to go through those documents. Sometimes it's hundreds and thousands of pieces of paper. This, I did the math, Rick. It was 30,000 pieces of paper that we were flipping through over the course of 2 weeks. Well, that takes a lot of time. So I'd get there around 8, 9 o'clock in the morning, and we'd leave around 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, we were there so many days, they sort of forgot we were there. And this has happened at a couple of government agencies where they just leave and you walk out and you're
turn
like, I'm
out,
here all by myself.
Close the door.
You were locked in?
No.
We weren't locked in, but
dark.
They had turned the lights out and closed the doors and we were like, hello? Anyone there? Yeah.
Wow.
So where are you seeing resistance? Is it just
everywhere?
A bureaucrat? Is it
everywhere.
Just some manager? Or is it a...
I think sometimes it's two things. I think sometimes it's just bureaucratic. It's just, we don't want to do this. We get so many of these, we don't want to deal with it. The D.C. Fire Department, we were in a year and a half, true blue battle where we were getting into legal territory with them. And we ended up finding out in a public hearing when they had to testify about the delay in our FOIAs that they were just throwing them in a box because they didn't have the people to sort through them. So sometimes
they're
it's bureaucratic. They're overwhelmed. I didn't appreciate, for instance, that every time there's a fire, all the lawyers FOIA. And so those were taking precedence over mine, which is technically not how it's supposed to work. But in their minds, it was this person's house burnt down. This reporter, she can wait. Right. Then there are the people who legitimately just don't want you to have it because they know it's not going to go well for them. They know we have now been in this town long enough where if they know who we are, or they do any research on us, they're probably going, oh, this may not go well for us. But that's a bad assumption. It may not be about you. It may be about something else. But I need those documents to see if there's anything there to begin with. And it may be helping your agency. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of jumping to the gun. If they want it, let's not give it to them. I don't want to deal with this. I don't want reporters in my backyard. I just don't want to deal with it. Fine. I mean, I know a lot of, particularly at the federal level, I know a lot of government types who legitimately say, yeah, we're just going to slow that one down.
Well, I was going to say, being in D.C. is a hell of a lot different than being in Paducah, Kentucky. I mean, everybody here is pretty
It's savvy. Funny. It's different
savvy,
than Baltimore,
exactly.
Maryland. I mean, I have friends who come to D.C. who are just stunned at how much harder it is to just do your daily job here. It's because everybody in this town, from the bus drivers on up to the president of the United States of America, has been media trained.
Everyone
is media savvy. Right. Everyone knows how it happens and they know how it works. Whereas in smaller markets, more rural areas or just not D.C., that's not the case. I mean, we have friends. I joke with them all the time. There's some amazing investigative reporters in New Orleans and Nashville, Tennessee. And they every single year have these just unbelievable corruption stories. They're not happening in the city. They're happening in the smaller precincts out in the county, out in the rural areas where people get away with stuff because no one's looking.
Right.
We don't have that sort of rural donut to like go look for the corruption. So we have to find the corruption here with the media savvy people. So it just takes longer, but it's still there.
How important is it, Rick, to know where to look? As far as knowing your laws, knowing what agencies are and how they list stuff and how they list documents. I imagine if you're starting in a market, you really have to just dive in and figure out, you know, how to navigate all of that stuff.
You do. I mean, especially being in this area, it was really tough to break into when I first moved here. I mean, I came from Charlotte, North Carolina, where I was the investigative reporter there with Stuart Watson, and I'd been there 5 years. And, you know, we had three main counties that we covered. You know, coming here, you have D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. Everyone has different laws and rules. So many different agencies, so many different law enforcement agencies. It can be overwhelming.
We're very jealous of our friends in Chicago because Chicago is one city and one county and one state.
And
for us, that's what, like It's like 7 or 8 jurisdictions in 3 different states.
It can be really hard to cover an investigative story here because our bosses will often say, okay, that's happening in Virginia, but did you find it's happening in Maryland and D.C.
Totally
too?
Different
and you're
laws.
Like, ugh, you know, because just because it's happening here doesn't mean it's happening there. But we have to look because that since we cover so much area.
And then right. You find yourself wasting all this time on an apples to oranges comparison right. because Virginia school systems are not the same as Maryland school systems. I mean, a really good example is VDOT runs all of the roads in Virginia, whereas in Montgomery County, there are local roads, there are county roads, and then there are state roads. So to do a snowplow story suddenly gets wicked hard because one is just run by a state budget with a state agency. The other one has 3 different budgets with 3 different. And then, oh, let's throw D.C. in there while we're at it, which isn't really a state, but it has state powers, but is a city. But they right. don't call them a city because they're more than a city. You know, it's just.
I mean, we really become experts in the topic that we're investigating. And mm-hmm. There's so much research that goes into it before we even get to the point of whether it's a story now. Because like you said, you have to figure out who even, you know, has oversight over this issue, which right. agency. And then you have to call that person. Then you talk to them. What kind of documentation do you maintain on this kind of thing?
So that which is why you want to go hyper-local.
Time. Right.
The more local you get at the ground level, the easier it is to tell the story. I can always tell when someone isn't really totally sure what they're doing with investigative reporting because they want to do this broad concept looking at education or Common Core across the 3 states. It's like you have a good time with that and you fit that into a 3-minute story. That's a very difficult thing to do. Whereas if you look at one school or one school district in a single grade, now we're talking mm-hmm. because you use
small
that
picture
microcosm.
Example of the bigger problem.
Exactly.
Okay.
And that's how we always do it.
And that's why the tipsters and the sources are so important.
Because they're the voice.
They're inside. They're telling you where to go as well.
I was going to say, a lot of reporters have relationships with the public information officers mm-hmm. or they know somebody who's a teacher at a school. But how do you find the person who's actually going to say, no, this is the document you actually need. This is what it, you know.
Most of the time with those document type stories like that, it's coming from a tip that we've received. And if you ask, you'll get them. And people are like, well, you've been here a long time. It's like, no, we tell people we want to hear from you. Tell us about what you're hearing. I mean, truly, our biggest stories that have had the most impact have always been very tip-based where we knew where to look for something.
And that took a while, though, to build that tip base because we came from another TV station. We've been at NBC for 3 years now, and we had to start a new tip line, and, you know, people weren't
– It took about a year for people to notice that we existed, to actually get some content on it.
So what are the nature of those tips? What is it people – sort of angers
Well,
people.
The tip line is kind of my baby. I listen to it every day, and there's a lot of crazies out there that call and just want to vent. And, you know, I would probably say for every 30 tips we get maybe – or for every 30 calls we get maybe 2 good tips worth pursuing. Not that they're going to be
those,
a story.
They may not happen.
And then they may not happen. So you have to weed through a lot. We get a lot of people complaining about, I bought a bad car or I, you know.
Which is nothing to laugh at.
Nothing
it's
to laugh
they
at.
Have
it's
to
just
be
we get
accumulated.
A lot of those. Right.
Yeah.
What we do, what we try to do with the tips and what I try to do is I look for patterns. I keep a list of every person that calls our tip line.
Wow.
And I will remember, like, I think I heard that exact same story. Like,
this is what makes his brain so
awesome. And this is what actually a story that we're working on right now. We started getting the exact same story in Maryland, D.C., and Virginia. And I'm like, that's interesting. So I look for patterns like that, and then we call the people, and then we, you know, find out their stories, and then we start putting it together.
Sometimes the story is so heart-wrenching or such a good story, you don't necessarily have to have right. a ton of tips that have the same thing. But you have to go find out if it's happened to other people. We're not going to do a story about a single person sure. who had a single problem. We will do a story about a single person who calls the tip line and says, dude, I just got ripped off by this company. And then we go to the attorney general's office and we find out that there's hundreds of complaints against that company. Mm-hmm. And then we look in the vast scheme of things and we find out, oh, guess what? Of all the automotive companies, they have the most complaints. So, yes, this one tip – We will walk it through to see whether or not it's happening to other people. And that's how AAMCO happened. We did a whole series on AAMCO, and we got very deep into AAMCO based on what in the beginning was just one tip that we remembered. And it was a $50 thing he was angry about.
I feel like we have to wrap it up, but I want to ask you quickly as far as, you know, if you want to be an investigative reporter or you're a reporter tired of doing crime scene live shots, if you're looking to kind of, you know, move on, Is CAR, that, you know, computer assisted reporting seminar, is that worth your time? Like, what would you guys say networking and joining a professional organization, or how would you say to kind of take it to the next level?
If you want to do investigative reporting, it is definitely worth your money and your time, even if it's coming out of your own pocket and it's your vacation to go to investigative reporters and editors. You truly, whether you end up becoming an investigative reporter or not, it truly is the best training ground. I really look
the conference
to
or
the conference. I think in one conference you can walk away with, I walk away every year with at least 30 story ideas that I want to pursue. You walk away with techniques. You can get all the training. If you want to get into database and computer assisted reporting, you can take all that training. I spent an entire conference one year just doing computer assisted reporting training. I didn't go to any panels. It also allows you to network. Going to the bar after the classes is over is just as important as anything else.
Right.
I think, though, at the very, very end, the most important thing is for you to start doing investigative reporting without anyone noticing. You spend an hour or two after work looking for some documents, putting in some FOIAs, you know, calling some sources, and you start to find one or two really good stories. You don't tell your boss about it. Do not pitch it in the morning meeting or they'll want it that day. You keep them in your back pocket and you get all the goods put together, and then you go to your boss and say, if you give me 2 extra hours in the morning, I will go shoot a couple of interviews and you'll have a killer story for the book that, you know, we'll just have a little extra meat. You under promise, you over deliver. They're like, that was amazing. Do that again. Okay, well, let me see if I can find another. I don't know. Blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And then you do it again. That is how I got to be an investigative reporter. I was the Nightside GA dead body reporter. And that's how I did it, slowly but surely.
Let me, before we wrap up, I did want to ask you to sort of circle back to something we were talking about before we started, social media. How does that figure into what you're doing, and what has been your experience?
As far as
both
like
good
and
bad tips and
well, if you Twitter it out, I'm probably not going to take it,
right,
because everybody
tweet,
else just saw tweet. Too.
Social
well, that's how I feel about
it. Double-edged sword. I mean, we have to use it. It's just a part of how we report nowadays. And so we're mainly using Twitter and Facebook to interact with our viewers, you know, to promote our stories, to give out little nuggets about our stories that, you know, you're going to see in the upcoming story. I don't think we've ever really gotten a lot of tips through
Twitter,
Facebook.
I mean,
Twitter,
there's people who use it as for crowdsourcing and for source development and stuff like that. But my difficulty with it is about half of my Twitter followers or other reporters, particularly people in this market,
right,
who want to know what I'm working on. So for me,
public.
it sort of defeats the purpose.
Mm-hmm. So it's more about branding for you
it
guys.
Is.
Well,
it is.
And
for us it is.
You know, I think it's a personal choice for every person, but or every reporter or producer. But for me, I probably come off as pretty stodgy on Twitter. I come off as pretty boring because I don't talk about my personal life on Twitter. I want Twitter to be a place when you see my stories on Facebook or Twitter. What you're seeing is the best journalism that I can possibly produce. And I'm not going to, you know, there's not going to be all this other white noise about my personal opinions, because my personal opinions don't matter in my journalism. My journalism is my journalism. Mm-hmm. And I know there are people out there who are more of personality driven based journalists. And so what they think matters, what I think should not matter in my reporting. And so my reporting is about what we found.
And also what we are reporting on has been so highly legaled. We have to be so careful about what we put out on social media because it could come back to haunt
us. Some of our tweets are legaled before we tweet them.
Yeah.
Because as we've been told by lawyers, when you look at tweets, think about what a lawyer or a jury would think about your tweets. And are your tweets completely one-sided?
If you put them all back to back, would it just present one side of the
story? You have 20 tweets about how this guy screwed up and then one tweet with his statement or any tweets with his statement.
Mm-hmm.
You don't. It doesn't matter what you did in your story. It's like promotions. You could get sued for those 20 tweets.
Because you're framing it in a certain way.
Well, you're making the guy look guilty without giving him his fair say. So social media is a very,
we're very
slippery slope in the investigative world. And so there's a reason why we're sort of stodgy.
Speaking of social media, where can our listeners find you guys on social media or on at NBC?
Well, go to NBCWashington.com/investigations. All of our stories are on there. Tisha, Scott's are all there. I'm at RickNBC on Twitter.
And I'm on at Tisha on TV was the only one I could find.
And also we're at NBC4i team as well.
Yeah. All right, guys. Thank you for coming in.
Yeah. Thank you for having
us.
This is
appreciate
so great.
It.
Yeah.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of digital news. Find more info on us and download other episodes at itsalljournalism.com. This podcast is produced in partnership with the Association of Alternative News Media. Thanks for listening.